Over the years, you've heard me moan about how wildlife in our neighborhood has tried to move in and live with us inside the house. I mean, we've fought off termites and earwigs and grubs, and we've killed a huge nest of yellow jackets kind of hiding under our siding, and there was a nest of bumblebees in our crawl space area. Had squirrels chew through our siding, take up residence in the attic, and then birds followed them. Chipmunks have eaten a lot of the insulation from a ductwork under the house. It never ends. There was a skunk last year that left his scent in our crawl space. I mean, that was not cool. It was not cool. So all these situations have conjured up in me kind of a heightened level of anger, you know? So most recently, maybe 3 months ago, I opened the front door, which our front door is adorned with an attractive wreath with some, you know, stuff hanging off of it. And when I opened the door, it was about 10 at night, I was startled by something that flew out of that wreath toward me. I don't know if it was a bird, a bat, you know, I had no idea. I must admit that I did ever so briefly scream momentarily. I didn't know. I didn't know if it was in the house. I didn't know if it stayed out of the house. I looked around. I didn't see anything. Like, okay, it just went out. Well, about an hour later, when we walked into the bedroom to, you know, finish the night out, something swooped down. I saw it in my peripheral. Something swooped down across the bedroom, and I looked over, and there's this bird that had landed on our ceiling fan. A little nasty thing sitting up there, thinking like he owned the bedroom. It's piling on. I mean, we've had all kinds of stuff now, and I'm piling on. I immediately get angry. I mean, right away, and I say out loud, "Why is this happening? You know, are you serious? Not again! What else can come into our home and invade this place?" So now the question is, how do you get a bird out of the house at 10 at night? Because I'm married to a genius, she had an idea. Let's turn out all the lights, open the front door, and turn the porch light on. And within moments, that little Tweety bird flew right toward the light and out of the house. And I'm like, well, okay, I got a little angry, you know, for not a whole lot of reason. But man, that made me mad instantly. I was like, ah. So I realize that some of you are kind of like me and you're might be sitting on a powder keg, you know, just ready to explode at the moment of any inconvenience, you know, like that. Or if you've been unfairly treated, or if your plan has been interrupted, or if somebody pulls in front of you in traffic, I mean, it's like, ah, you know, and there you are. You're just really angry. I remember this was a long, long time ago, and the person I'm going to tell the story on, I don't even know where they are anymore, but I pulled out of this entrance onto New Nicholasville and went this way. And there was a car that came. I probably should have waited, but I didn't. I pulled out, and they kind of slowed down and made a gesture, you know, with their right hand. And I looked in the mirror, and it was one of our college students. I'm like, I see you giving me that little gesture there. We see this all the time around us, people's fuses being burned up and then the explosion. And, you know, too often those standing nearby get hurt from the shrapnel that's kind of flying around. So this morning we're going to talk about anger. And Moses is our case study. Because of anger, Moses was left stranded on the edge of a dream of the promised land. And our anger will do the same. It will keep us from realizing our dreams and God's dreams for our life as well. So it may be time to allow God's transforming power to change you and me in this area of anger. According to people who like to make lists, anger has 5 levels of intensity. You can kind of find yourself along the spectrum. First one's mild irritation. You know, something makes me uneasy, something makes me annoyed, a fly buzzing around, you know, at night, or a bird that wakes you up in the morning. It's like, you know, it's just irritated. Secondly, it goes to indignation. You know, you're reacting to something that's unfair. You're yelling at an official at a basketball game or some kind of game, or somebody like in traffic pulls out in front of you. And that moves to wrath. Wrath is next. The wrath never goes unexpressed. You have a strong desire to defend or to avenge. And then the next level is fury. It's violent. I mean, it's a loss of sanity. We lash out. Fury is what often goes on with domestic violence. And the final one is rage. Just an intense, overcoming violence erupts without conscious awareness of what you're doing. You may not even know what you did when it's over. And you know what's frightening? Just take a look at those, especially toward the bottom of the list. Every one of us has the potential to let our anger run the full course. We have the capacity, each one of us, to do unspeakable things in a fit of rage. The reason we usually don't is only because we're under control of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is like a governor on a go-kart at Malibu Jacks. It keeps our speed down just so we don't wipe out all the time. Those without the Spirit have little hope of controlling their anger. And even some of us, if the truth were exposed, are all too familiar with an explosive anger. And you may feel guilt or shame because of words shouted or threats yelled, or maybe because you actually hit someone at some point in your life. Well, we've been studying the life of Moses the past few weeks, and although Moses was a godly man and a great leader, Moses had a temper, and he never did seem to get it under control. And that may make you feel better to know that you're in good company with Moses, but you may not like the serious consequences which also accompanied his uncontrolled anger. Moses, he just never really learned how to control his anger. So we're going to track this for a few minutes by beginning back in Exodus 2, and we're going to walk through four different scenes in Moses' life, and anger is going to be like the theme in each one of these scenes. Exodus 2 is scene 1, verse 11 and 12. Well, I think this is the third time we've read this little part in our series on Moses, but let's do it one more time. One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. I think most would agree this was an excessive choice that Moses made. He became indignant with the injustice his people were experiencing, and his anger erupted in an extremely violent outburst. I mean, he committed murder. He dug a grave, he shoved his victim in it, and he chose to take vengeance into his own hands. He did not trust God enough to leave justice with him. So Moses took off to the desert for 40 years, and he learned lots of things about himself. He learned lots of things about the desert and about his God, and he was equipped to lead the exodus of Israel while in the desert without even knowing that's what was going on with him. But he did not learn how to control his anger. That's scene one. The next scene, Moses comes back to Egypt, and where we're looking at in this journey, Moses has met with Pharaoh 9 times before the final plague came. Between plague number nine and number 10, Moses visited Pharaoh again, and he had it up to here. I mean, he was on his last nerve. He's at a point where he can't really see straight, and even though God promised, "I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart," here's what happened. In chapter 11 of Exodus. So Moses said, this is what the Lord says. About midnight, I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the female slave who's at her handmill, and all the firstborn cattle as well. There will be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there has ever been or ever will be again. And all these officials of yours will come to me, bowing down before me, saying, "Go, you and all the people who follow you." After that, I will leave. And then Moses, what are the next 3 words? Hot with anger, left Pharaoh. Moses left hot with anger. It's the strongest Hebrew word available to express anger. And that's how he walked out of the palace. Moses was severely ticked off as he headed out of Pharaoh's presence. And God said to him, "Look, Moses, I'm going to take care of Pharaoh. You don't have to get so angry. All you've got to do is tell him, let my people go." And instead, Pharaoh's stubbornness and pride infuriated Moses. So that's scene two. He's hot with anger. Scene three is in Exodus 32. People have come to Sinai, the mountain of God. Moses had gone up to the mountain to receive the law of God. The nation of Israel remains down below, and they're tired of waiting for Moses to return. You remember this story. And as they get more and more impatient, somebody has this idea, let's build a calf and worship it instead, which kind of comes out of the blue, but that's what they did. So while Moses is up in the clouds getting the law from God in God's own handwriting, down below in the valley, the Israelites are dancing and partying before this golden calf. Exodus 32:15. Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. Can you imagine holding those tablets of stone that God personally wrote on, and he entrusted those to Moses? Verse 17, when Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "This is the sound of war in the camp." And Moses replied, "It's not the sound of victory. It is not the sound of victory. It is not the sound of defeat. It is the sound of singing that I hear." When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and dancing, his anger burned. His anger burned. Here's a question. I mean, shouldn't he have gotten angry with what he walked into? You know, that seems justified. I mean, this may be somewhat like an angry, like the anger a parent feels when a child just willfully rebels. You said no, but they did it anyway. And man, it just like, what are you doing? Didn't you listen to me? It's the expression of his anger that's inexcusable. God never excused Moses' response. Verse 19, his anger burned, Moses' anger burned. He threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. So in a moment of rage, he threw the stone tablets down and he shattered them. And that's what was uncalled for. I wonder, after coming to his senses, if Moses didn't try to pick those up and super glue them back together. You know, you ever do that when you're a kid? You broke a vase or, you know, a plate and you try to repair it so that nobody notices. You know, it doesn't work. Just experience tells me that doesn't work. Here's a little side note to parents. We must teach our children acceptable ways to express their anger. On the playground, what do you do when somebody steals the ball from you? Or when someone cuts in front of you at the water fountain? Or any myriad of things that, you know, opportunities to get angry with others. We have way too many examples of adults who are not taught to control their anger as children. Did you know there's a specific law that makes assaulting a referee a felony? I mean, why would we need a law like that? Because people are crazy. That's why. People are crazy. I had a friend I reffed with who got punched in the nose refereeing a church league game. Like, come on. You know, I used to referee quite a bit of basketball, but one day, I can remember it was in Madison County. I just got berated after the game and through the game, and I walked away with my check for $30. I thought, this is not worth it. I think I might have reffed one more time after that. It's just not worth it. And I really enjoyed it. It just wasn't worth the criticism, the attacks. So what are you teaching your kids when you yell at a ref? I mean, it's a game. People make mistakes. You make mistakes. You know, it's kind of funny. If you go to Rupp Arena and you're sitting three rows from the top of the whole thing, and you got this guy next to you. He's like, he walked. I'm like, I can't even see his feet. I mean, your eyesight is incredible. And your attitude is terrible, you know? Like, let's grow up. Adults, we just need to teach our children how to handle our anger maybe better than we have. So back to Moses. He broke the tablets because he had an uncontrolled temper. God never told him what he did was okay. In fact, we see an implied disapproval when Moses was given the law again in chapter 34. The Lord passed in front of Moses proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. You know, are those words primarily meant for Moses, maybe? Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and Israel. Moses was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights without eating bread or drinking water. And he wrote on the tablets, the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. So this time around, Moses had to write out the Ten Commandments. Scene number four takes us to Numbers 20. Israel's on the edge of the Promised Land. There's 39 years of traveling, and they complained, it seemed like, every step of the way. And Moses, I mean, any of us would be thoroughly irritated, you know, trying to lead folks that complained all the time. The complaining, the whining, I mean, it seemed to be endless. And yet God continued to graciously provide for their needs. Here's the first part of Numbers 20. In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, and they stayed at Kadesh. There Miriam died and was buried. Miriam is Moses' sister. And there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. And they quarreled with Moses and said, I mean, this is a refrain all through Exodus and Numbers. If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this wilderness that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink. So they're still whining, they're still griping to the very end. And now remember Moses' character flaw as we read this next paragraph. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting and fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together. Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. And you will bring water out of the rock for the community so they and their livestock can drink. So the instructions seem pretty clear. Take your staff, go to the rock, speak to the rock, get out of the way, because water is going to gush out of there. So verse 9, Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he commanded him, so far so good. Verse 10, he and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, now listen to what he says, to the words of a man given to anger. Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? And then Moses raised his arm, and he struck the rock twice with his staff, and water gushed out, and the community and the livestock drank. You know, where is that in God's instructions? He didn't quite follow very well. And I get it. You know, Moses was, he's had it. He's had it with his people. He's full of anger. He's buried lots of his friends because of his perpetual unbelief and complaining. And acting in unbelief, he took the staff and he preached a sermon. And he decided to let them have it. Shall we bring water? You know, what's up with that? Moses had never brought water out of a rock. That's what God does. God is the one who does that kind of thing. When acting in rage, you set aside your right mind and you're driven by these emotions of anger. What did God say to do? He said, speak to the rock. And instead, he raised his staff and he slammed it down twice on that rock. I wonder, do you think Moses expected water to come out at that point? You know, he just may have been surprised to learn how patient God is. Here's a question for you. When have you been knowingly disobedient and God still provides, God still proves his faithfulness to you? When have you been knowingly disobedient and God still proves his faithfulness to you? That's it. It's a terrible feeling when you realized it's happened. While you were cursing him or forgetting him, he was blessing you. And the Hebrew word for that is hesed. The English word is grace. That's what brought water out of the rock. But don't think God overlooked Moses' little temper tantrum. Verse 12, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. And my tendency is to think the punishment God chose for Moses was a little too severe. I mean, who wouldn't have lost his temper with these grumblers in the desert? They grumbled from day one to year 40, all along, every day, same old tune. Why did you bring us out here to die? We're better off in Egypt. We need water. We want meat. Every day for 39 years. And he just buried his sister as well. I mean, couldn't God have cut him some slack? Well, I think here's the problem. This isn't just a snapshot of a temper tantrum. This is a full-length movie. Moses had a temper problem since he was 40, and probably long before that. He hasn't learned much in this area. God has tolerated it. He patiently put up with it. He waited on Moses, and Moses continues to break tablets and strike rocks, and God says, that's enough. That's enough. And what a heartbreaking consequence. I mean, Moses had worked half his life getting Israel to this parcel of land, and he was left at the altar, standing on the edge of a dream. In Deuteronomy, Moses prayed specifically for this sentence to be overturned, and God bluntly says to him, don't pray for that again. The answer is no. God held him. God taught him. God had been patient with him. He had forgiven him until finally he said, that's enough. So I want to make two simple applications from this aspect of Moses' life. The first one is this. My disobedience, your disobedience, smears God's name. And I want to say this especially to leaders. You know, I want if you're a leader, I want you to pay special attention to these words in James 3, which kind of support this principle. Verse 1, not many of you, James writes, should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. So God has a stricter measure of judgment for teachers and for leaders. I mean, every one of us who claims to be a Christian lives in a fishbowl. And Christian leaders live in a fishbowl that's kind of held higher up for everybody else to see. We are on display. Leaders set an example for the congregation of God's people. It says so right in James 3, even though we may want to deny it sometimes. Anyone who wears the Team Christian jersey, you are a public letter displayed to the world, to your family and friends, to the PTA, to those in your office, those in your classroom. Our acts of obedience, our acts of disobedience, smear God's name every time. I understand I have lots of eyes on me. Besides my two own adult children, plus a daughter-in-law and a son-in-law and three grandkids and my wife, I have a few hundred alumni from 30 years of hanging out with college students, and I have all of you. There's a skeptical community and a media just waiting to bust another church leader. And lots of people are watching. And many are only looking for us to make mistakes. So here are a few options I've explored in response to life in the fishbowl. You can be intimidated and be totally ineffective because you're too busy hiding out. You can be arrogant. You can say, I deserve to be an example. Look how good I am. You can try to jump out of the fishbowl and deny the truth of James 3. But here's the deal. You can't teach God's way if you don't get back in the bowl, trying to do things your way. If you don't want a fishbowl life, get out of the teaching business and get out of the leading business. It's like Charles Barkley said many years ago. He said, I'm not a role model for kids. Well, that's part of the gig, Chuck, you know. Kids idolize NBA players. It comes with a jersey. It comes with the paycheck. It's just what it is. So I say to us, be God's woman and be God's man and trust him to change you, to make you real, to forgive you, to use you in spite of your flaws and your cracks, just like he did Moses. To be honest, I've tried all those options in the past, and I'll tell you what, the last one works best because God is truly my only audience. And he's a whole lot more forgiving and patient than any human audience I've ever met. I'll take him over any of y'all every day of the week. We don't live on an island. Our choices impact people. And our choice today to disobey God smears his name, and God takes that very seriously. Secondly, my disobedience results in consequences, sometimes very painful consequences. You know, did God forgive Moses of his temper tantrum? Won't God forgive me when I lose my temper or when I act selfishly or when I spread some juicy gossip? Let's say you have a continual pattern of disobedience in a particular area, and you've smeared God's name over the years through that disobedience. I believe from Moses' story, we learn God may deal severely with that area of our life that's disobedient. He forgives us, but the consequences of our choices are sometimes terribly painful. Have you ever said more than you know you should have, or were hypercritical, or lost your cool with someone? You know, and even though you apologize sincerely, and even though the other person forgives you, your relationship with them will suffer some consequences. Things can't be just like they used to be. You know, we say, let's just be friends, or can't we just start over? I mean, that often leaves us with this hollow feeling inside. Forgiveness doesn't mean everything will be peachy. We cannot go back to the Garden of Eden, even though we're forgiven. Every choice for disobedience we make hurts God's image because we're his representatives. God simply doesn't turn his head when his holiness is being smeared by one of his children. He will not always remain patient. Forgiving, yes, but we will still have to face the consequences of our decisions. So God has set these two principles in the context of Moses' temper. And this may be a message you need to hear because you have trouble controlling your anger too, just like Moses. The only people who may know are those closest to you, those in your own home. But you're hurting them every time you lose your cool. And you smear God's name every time as well. So I invite you this morning to make a decision to stop today. Confess you have a problem with anger. Tell God you want to be transformed. Pray for change. Listen for his leading. Be in tune with the Holy Spirit and establish some accountability in your life. God will be faithful to use all of his resources within you, outside of you, beyond you, to fill your life with peace instead of anger. Don't be stranded on the edge of a dream because you didn't deal with your temper. Let's stand together and sing.